Author and humorist Matt Geiger believes that the thing philosophers really seek more than truth, more even than knowledge, is the opportunity to be amazed. With this as a starting point, he has a new collection of stories and essays. It is called Astonishing Tales, Stories and Essays, Your Astonishment May Vary. Matt Geiger is a writer. His work includes The Geiger Counter, Raised by Wolves, and other stories. And again, the new book is Astonishing Tales. It's a great pleasure to welcome Matt Geiger to the roundtable this morning. Matt, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me on.
Nice to have you on the program. So what brought this collection to be?
I mean, if you look at the table of contents, it probably looks fairly random. You know, it's about parenting and chickens and the apocalypse and Neanderthal DNA and boxers and circus performers. But
and befuddlement. Don't forget befuddlement.
Yes. Befuddlement, yes. That's also a theme through the book. What it's all about is a quote that I put down by Borges when I sat down to write the book, which is this idea that there are these philosophers, and rather than seeking truth, they're seeking awe and astonishment. And that's kind of the premise of all the stories in one way or another.
How do you define astonishment? How does that work for you?
Well, it all has to do with vision. And the writer Knausgård, who I like very, very much, he talks about the faint shimmer of strangeness, he calls it, when you, let's say you go on vacation and then you come back to your house or apartment after a week being gone, and everything that seems so commonplace that you never even really looked at before has this shimmer of strangeness about it because you're really looking at it because you've been away from it. And I think astonishment is a capacity, and there's a story in the book about a two-headed calf in Sherlock Holmes that kind of covers this. But it's the ability to see things with their little shimmer of strangeness about them. And that's a big part of astonishment, for me at least.
When it comes to telling the stories, was this stories that you had and you collect, or did you mentioned a moment ago, I mean, did you have a mission statement and say, okay, this is going to go in a more linear fashion?
Yeah, they're pretty scattered. I mean, some of them have appeared elsewhere first on radio programs or in journals and things like that. Most of them are new. But they're certainly not in the book in the order I wrote them or anything like that. I don't want to say they're random, but they do trod on all sorts of terrain, from Russian history to board games to Easter eggs to dandelions and lawn maintenance.
And there's a lot there. There's a lot to mine there, isn't there?
Yeah.
So tell me about the two-headed calf. How did you come across the two-headed calf?
Yeah, that one certainly is kind of a quintessential story in this collection. And that's about, I was doing a book reading. I live in Wisconsin, and I was on my way home, and I stopped at a gas station. And because it's Wisconsin, of course, they sell cheese and sausage, because they sell cheese and sausage everywhere in Wisconsin. And there's a big display case, and over the top of it was the stuffed, mounted heads of a calf. And I went over to the clerk, and I kind of said, what's the deal with that? And he said, with what? And I said, with the mutant animal that's over the food there. And he was like, oh, I don't really know. And I thought, oh, that's amazing. He works here, and he doesn't even know where it's from. And I said, well, you must get a lot of questions about it. And he said, no, I think most people don't notice it. And I thought, oh, right, because everyone is busy, and they're going through their life, or they're not seeing all the weird stuff around them. So I wanted to find out about it, and I ended up finding the owners of the gas station, and the calf was real. It wasn't a taxidermist hoax or something. And she was born on a farm nearby, and her back broke during the delivery, and so she got to be alive for a few moments, and then that glint that none of us really understands went out of her four eyes, and that was it. And I'm lucky enough, I've been alive for 39 years, and we're going around, and she just had that moment. So I thought and it's Christmas time now, so she has reindeer antlers on and lights around her and stuff, and they have fun with her.
Oh.
But I thought that was a good way to think about mortality.
Yeah. But don't you worry that, I mean, there's still dignity even in death, that, you know, you're hanging up there in the gas station, and you've got antler ears and a red nose, and I don't know. Is that a dignified way to go out?
I don't know. I mean, I have this idea that things can be both funny and sad, or, you know, both, maybe even, you know.
Well, that's certainly very true. I agree with you there.
Yeah, and so there are plenty of paradoxes that I'm okay with, and maybe that's one. That might not be that dignified, but she's there, and she serves as, to me, it was a very poignant reminder of life and sometimes the brevity of life.
You write in a chapter called Existential Christmas, I judge each child I meet based on her or his merits. I don't always end up liking them, but at least those who receive my love have done something to deserve it. I'm not the only one who does. That's a cool way to live.
Well, I don't, people, when they talk about, well, children or anything, they tend to make some pretty broad statements, right? I always meet people who either say they, A, don't like children, or the other thing is people say, oh, I love children, I love all children. And I always thought it was kind of, you know, Santa's this very famous judger of children, right?
Yes.
And I thought, well, maybe I'll judge each child I meet based on their merits. And obviously I give children the benefit of the doubt more than adults, but that the idea is to apply that to adults as well. And that story is very much about, that story ends up being actually about mythologies and how they help us make our way through our daily lives. Of course, the Santa mythology is one that I find kind of compelling and weird and strange and funny.
Yeah, I mean, you say that, it, like any mythology, its power does not rely on any of its components being literally true.
Hmm. Yeah, and I think mythologies, you know, stories that aren't all literally true, but that are nonetheless powerful, are, I think they're a form of art, and I think they're a type of language, and it's a way we can talk about things we don't understand. Stephen Fry, the author and actor, he had a book that came out a while back about Greek mythology. And he talks about the goddess of the hearth and kind of how people would come together around the hearth at night and they would talk about things they couldn't understand or couldn't control. And I think that's, to this day, what our mythologies still do for us.
Is it safe to say, and I don't like labeling like this, of whether you be a Southern writer or a New England writer, but is there something to a Midwestern sensibility that you think comes out in your work?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think about it a lot, actually, because I grew up in New England, and I live down south, and I live in the Midwest now. And I do take, we all, when we live in places, little bits of those places kind of seep into who we are, right? That's another thing that this book is about, the Neanderthal story and things like that. Identity, and identity is not a fixed thing, right? We're kind of becoming who we are throughout our lives and throughout the stories. And there's even a thing by Proust in there about how when he wakes up, he's more destitute than a cave dweller because he doesn't remember who he is, but then he remembers all the places he's been. And those memories kind of reach down like a rope from heaven to pull him up out of the abyss of not being, which I think is just beautiful. So I think all those places I've been and the place I currently am are certainly part of who I am as a writer. I think there are a lot of very funny Midwestern writers, so I hope I can learn a little bit from some of the other very funny writers out there.
You write about John Updike in the book.
Yeah, I met John Updike when I grew up in New England, and I met him when I was a little kid. And, of course, if I met him today, A, I'd be shocked because he'd be undead or a zombie or something. But,
right.
But
taxidermied on the wall of the gas
right,
station.
Yeah, there you go. But I'd be, you know, obviously very scared and thrilled and nervous and excited. But as a kid, I just wanted to go read comic books or something. And my dad, I grew up on a farm, and my dad sold compost, and he sold compost. We brought cow manure to John Updike's house. And that's weird, right? I mean, everything.
Well,
that's
a story.
Strangeness to that.
Yeah, and that's also a great way to end a book, as you do. I think that's just a great ending.
Thank you very much.
And oh, by the way, I did this.
Yeah.
I do notice that the stories are relatively short, and are you're comfortable with that form?
Absolutely. Part of it, I'm sure, is the limitations on my abilities as a writer, probably, but. But it took 2 years to write this, and it was much longer at first, obviously, after, you know, or before cutting non-essential things. But I was reading Chekhov every day, or almost every day, while writing this. And I love Chekhov. I like Russian writers a lot. And Chekhov is such a funny and insightful Russian writer. And I kind of took him like medicine, just my dose of Chekhov every day. And he, so many of his stories are so short. Some of his best, most powerful stories to me are, you know, 2-3 pages maybe. I was just reading some Truman Capote the other day, and I was realizing that about his stories as well. Stories don't have to be long to be powerful, I hope.
I never thought of Chekhov as overly funny, though.
Well,
what am I missing?
Once again, so a lot of people think because he's so dreary that he's not funny,
yes.
Right? But you agreed with me earlier that things can be both sad and funny.
That is true. No, that is true. That is true. I agree. I do agree with you. The book is really fun. It's called Astonishing Tales, Stories and Essays. It is out, and what a great pleasure, Matt. Thank you very much for spending time with us.
It was wonderful. Thank you for having me on.
Again, a great pleasure to have you on. Again, the name of the new book is Astonishing Tales, Stories and Essays. Your astonishment may vary. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.